So you may have some complaints about my preaching, but probably a lack of thoroughness is not one of them. So this is going to be part 18, and the last part, I'm sure everybody breathes a sigh of relief, on the deception series. And I do want to talk about godly deception today, but before I do, I had some thoughts this week on a couple of things that I probably left out. If you can imagine, after 25 hours of talking, I left a couple things out, but just some other things that would be pointers to remind yours to remember to not be deceived. And one of them is what I would call confirmation bias. You know, we all tend to filter what we hear through what we already believe, and then when we hear things that confirm what we already believe, then we accept those right away and we never even really give them a second thought. But then if we hear things that are contrary to what we already believe, then we want to scrutinize that and not accept it, right? If a Republican watches CNN, he doesn't believe anything he sees on there. Same guy turns on Fox News and believes everything he hears without even considering it, right? It's just an example. And it would be the other way around with a left-wing guy watching CNN versus watching Fox kind of thing. So we want to be careful about that, because that is an easy way where we can be deceived, where we just automatically assume that whatever we hear that sounds like what we already believe is the truth, and we just accept that and we don't even scrutinize it. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. So I think a lot of people in our faith, we tend to be opposed to the mainstream, and not just in our church, but in the churches of like faith. And that's fine. And that's probably a safe bet to be, as opposed to the mainstream, right? Broad is the gate, wide is the way which leadeth to destruction, right? So the path that most people are on is the wrong one. But we do want to be careful about that. And we tend to be against the mainstream, some people, not all of us, in different degrees, but maybe diet, medical care, politics, history, those kind of things. We look at things a certain way, and we tend to think that people look at them a different way are probably just, you know, uninformed, ignorant, you know, rubes that don't know anything. But going against the mainstream by default is not always maybe the correct position. So you don't want to believe every claim that you read by the alternative medicine community, for instance. And I know a lot of people are into alternative medicine, and that's fine. But to just hear something that's alternative, to hear something that's against the conventional wisdom, and just assume it must be right because it's against the conventional wisdom, is not wise. And I have noticed people that get into alternative medicine, it's usually one thing to the next, right? They jump on one bandwagon, and then they're on that bandwagon for a short time, and this is the panacea that's going to cure all my health problems. And then a month or a year later, they're on to another thing, and another thing, and another thing. And so obviously, all the previous ones weren't the panacea that they thought they were going to be, right? So you just want to be careful about that, just accepting everything you hear just because it's got to be right, because it's against these, you know, these greedy doctors out there or whatever that are trying to screw us all. Or believing every conspiracy theory you hear. You know, you don't want to believe every conspiracy theory that you hear. Now, I believe my share of conspiracy theories, and there's nothing wrong with that, but you don't want to be one of these types that every single thing you hear, you latch right onto it, because, you know, there are liars out there in the conspiracy community, just like there are liars out there in the media and in every other place. But on the other side of the coin, you don't also want to assume that everything in the mainstream is right. And I don't think probably anybody in here would fall into that camp, but you don't want to assume if the authorities say it, it must be true, right? If I heard it on the news, it's got to be right, that kind of thing. You don't want to believe every medical expert in conventional medicine. So you don't want to believe all the alternative people, but you don't want to believe everybody in conventional medicine either, because you know what? They're people, and they mess up, and they get things wrong. I think a great example, Brother Ben, if you don't mind me using your situation here, but he goes to the doctor. He had some cancer cut out of his head, and he has some bumps back there again. He goes to the doctor, and the doctor says the cancer has spread. How does he know the cancer spread? He's got some bumps on his head. I mean, there's maybe cancer on his head again. No, maybe it has, but we don't know that. How's he know? He hasn't done a scan. How would he know the cancer spread? You don't have any lumps on the rest of your body, right? So how would he know? And then so they're going to cut the cancer out here, and they're going to cut off a lymph node. He's already determined this before he's even done a scan. And who cuts off body parts before you even do a scan to find out where it's spread? I mean, it's just like that kind of thing. You don't want to necessarily just toe the line to everything a medical professional says, because sometimes they get it wrong too. Or you don't want to believe the official story about all events that you hear either, right? Because people do lie. And probably the official story is wrong most of the time. That's probably the truth. But you just want to steer between those two extremes of not believing anything you hear and believing everything you hear, right? Prove all things. Hold fast that which is good, whether they fit into your mindset or not. And it's hard to do. You really have to make an effort, because we're all like that. I'll be totally honest with you. When I read a story that says that the whole coronavirus pandemic is a bunch of nonsense and it's overblown and blah, 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 I'm inclined to believe it, right? But there are other people out there that would be just the opposite. When they read stories about dead bodies piling up everywhere, they're inclined to believe it, right? Because they have a different mindset than I do. And so we're all going to accept whatever we've determined to be the truth. So we just want to try to be truth-seeking people and really try to examine everything on its merits. And when we do that, we'll be a lot less likely to be deceived. Okay, so now let's get to what I wanted to talk about this morning, and that is godly deception. And as I mentioned last Sunday, it is kind of odd that I spent 17 Sundays telling you how deception is evil and you should not do it and you should avoid it and teaching you how to resist it, right, and to identify it and that kind of thing. And now I'm going to spend the last sermon telling you how it's okay under certain circumstances, and sometimes you should actually do it. You should actually deceive people. And that sounds crazy, right? But I will show you this. I'm going to try to split it up, rightly divide the word of truth to show you when it's okay to deceive and when it's not. There are circumstances in life where deception is acceptable, and sometimes where it's outright necessary. Now, some people, I'll lose some people. I've already lost some people. When they heard just the first few sentences that I just said there, that you can deceive people and should deceive people sometimes, some people out there I've already lost. And I've met people like that. I mean, they just can't think beyond those words right there and think, nope, that's impossible. But if you keep listening and you open your Bible and read it, I think you'll come to see what I'm talking about. I'm just going to give you a few examples here, and then we're going to get into biblical examples of deception. So the first one would be war. Now, anybody that knows me knows that I'm anti-war. I'm about as anti-war as it gets. I'm not a pacifist, but I'm anti-war except when it comes to wars of self-defense. So pretty much pick a war in the last 200 years, and I'm against it pretty well. But sometimes war is necessary when it is for self-defense. And when you're in a war, you are going to have to learn to be a deceptive, deceitful person, because you're going to lose if if you call up the enemy and say, hey, we're going to be at this coordinate tomorrow at noon, so, get ready. You're going to lose, right? You need to show up unannounced, unexpected, and make them think you're somewhere where you're not, right? I mean, it's all about deception. I'll give you some quotes here in just a second. But, the Bible actually affirms this. Israel used this whenever they fought against a nation called Ai. If you turn with me to Joshua chapter 7, 3 through 5, Israel had gone up against Ai, and they were defeated, and there was a reason for that. And the reason for that was that they had this sinner in the camp. His name was Achan, and Achan had kept some of the spoil, and he had taken a gold wedge and a Babylonian garment and something else and hidden it and thought that nobody would know about it, and he found out that your sin will find you out. Well, anyway, what happened was, because there was sin in the camp, the Lord judged Israel and did not allow them to win the war. Just a side note, why do you suppose that we haven't won a war in, 70 years or something like that since World War II? Right, we haven't won a war, have we? Korea, Vietnam, Iraq War, Afghanistan War, no, we didn't win any of these wars. Why do you think that is? Well, I don't know. At the same time that we wholeheartedly turned our backs on God in the 1960s, we haven't won a war since, have we? Isn't that interesting? But anyway, Joshua chapter 7, 3 through 5, it says, "And they returned to Joshua and said unto him, Let not all the people go up, and let about 2,000 or 3,000 men go up and smite Ai, and make not all the people to labor thither, for they are but few." So they're all, they're quite proud of themselves here, thinking we don't even need to send out the whole, the whole army. Just send out a company here, because these people aren't very many. So there went up thither of the people about 3,000 men, and they fled before the men of Ai, and the men of Ai smote of them about 36 men, For they chased them from before the gate, even unto Shebarim, and smote them in the going down. There, wherefore, the hearts of the people melted and became as water. So they got beat because of this. Once they took care of Achan, once they took care of the sinner in the midst of the camp, then the Lord was on their side, and the Lord told them what to do, to go up against Ai again, but this time they were supposed to set an ambush behind the city. Now, an ambush is, I'll read to you the verse here, and then I'll define ambush. Joshua chapter 8, verses 1 through 2. It says, And the Lord said unto Joshua, Fear not, neither be thou dismayed. Take all the people of war with thee, and arise, go up to Ai, see, I have given into thy hand the king of Ai and his people and his city and his land, and thou shalt do to Ai and her king as thou didst unto Jericho and her king, only the spoil thereof and the cattle thereof shall ye take for a prey unto yourselves, lay thee an ambush for the city behind it. So this is God himself telling them to set an ambush. An ambush is a military disposition consisting of troops concealed in a wood or other place in order to surprise and fall unexpectedly upon an enemy. So this definition has deceit dripping from it, doesn't it? Because you are doing something when you set an ambush and making somebody think that you're doing something else, or they don't realize what you're doing. You're setting them up to be tricked, right? You're going to unexpectedly fall upon them. That's a deceptive tactic. They were then to approach the city again, and then they would flee when the men of Ai came out. So it's a brilliant idea. So they set an ambush behind the city, and then the rest of the army approaches the city from right up to the main gate, and Ai is going to see them coming out to do battle with them again, and Ai is thinking, we're going to whoop up on them like we did last time, and they send everybody out of the city and chase after them, and as soon as Ai comes out, they turn around and run, so all the men chase them out of the city, and then they get ambushed. Verses 3 through 8. So Joshua arose and all the people of war to go up against Ai, and Joshua chose out 30,000 mighty men of valor and sent them away by night. See? Deception, right? By night, so nobody knows what's going on. They're being sly and tricky. And he commanded them, saying, Behold, ye shall lie in wait against the city, even behind the city. Go not very far from the city, but be ye all ready. And I and all the people that are with me will approach unto the city, and it shall come to pass, when they come out against us, as at the first, that we will flee before them. For they will come out after us, till we have drawn them from the city. For they will say, They flee before us, as at the first, therefore we will flee before them. Then ye shall rise up from the ambush and seize upon the city, for the Lord your God will deliver it into your hand. And it shall be, when ye have taken the city, that ye shall set the city on fire, according to the commandment of the Lord shall ye do. See, I have commanded you. So, I pretty much already explained what they were going to do, what this verse says here. So they're going to show up. They're going to draw the men of Ai out of the city, and then once they're out of the city, then the ambush comes around and sets the city on fire behind them, and they don't have a clue what's happening until it's too late. And that's exactly what happened here in verses 14 through 17. And it came to pass, when the king of Ai saw it, that they hasted and rose up early, and the men of the city went out against Israel to battle, he and all his people, at a time appointed before the plain. But he wist not that there were liars in ambush against him behind the city. And Joshua and all Israel made as if they were beaten before them. That's deception right there. Made as if they were beaten. They weren't beaten. They were tricking him. They were lying, in a sense. And fled by the way of the wilderness. And all the people that were in Ai were called together to pursue after them. And they pursued after Joshua and were drawn away from the city. And there was not a man left in Ai or Bethel that went not out after Israel. And they left the city open and pursued after Israel. And then what ends up happening is once the men are all out of there, then they go and they attack the city and they set it on fire. And then the men of Ai turn around and look and see the smoke rising from the city, and they realize they've been defeated. And that's in the next few verses there, and I'm not going to read that. I'm sure you're familiar with this story. But that right there is a classic act of deception in war. I think a military general and military commanders should read accounts like this in the Bible and other accounts and learn some things about war fighting. There's a guy named Sun Tzu. Anybody ever heard of Sun Tzu? Yep, Sun Tzu. He wrote a book called The Art of War. He published it just shortly before Amazon started their self-publishing thing, so he had to get somebody else to put it out for him. But it was done about 2,600 years ago, a long time ago. And I'm going to give you some quotes here from it. Now, I'm assuming that this is a valid translation, and I'm sure there are many translations. It's probably not the best translation. Just as we read it, it kind of sounds like a third grader wrote it or something. But the substance of it is good, even though the grammar is not the greatest. He said there in this book, he said, all warfare is based on deception. And then I'm just going to give you several other quotes here that he gave. This is from page 44 and 45. He said, hence, when able to attack, we must seem unable. When using our forces, we must seem inactive. When we are near, we must make the enemy believe we are far away. When far away, we must make him believe that we are near. So deceiving him, making him think the exact opposite, tricking them. He says, hold out baits to entice the enemy, feign disorder, and crush him. This is exactly what Joshua did, wasn't it? Hold out baits, went marched right up there to the city. As soon as they come out, they turn around and run, right? They baited him out of the city. Feign disorder, right? Running away. Everything, you know, the whole army's just falling apart. And then they crush him. You see? Joshua had this figured out before Sun Tzu had it figured out. And I should say God had it figured out, obviously, because God is the one that told him how to do this. He says, if your opponent is of choleric temper, seek to irritate him. So you can really get the best of somebody. If somebody can't keep their temper under control, and you just start poking at them, and then they flip out and blow up, and then they've lost control of themselves. Right? He that hath no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls. This is what Sun Tzu was talking about, though he certainly wasn't a Christian, probably never even heard of the Bible before. Pretend to be weak, that he may grow arrogant. Isn't that exactly what Joshua did? He pretended to be weak. The king of Ai said, we're going to go out as we did before. Right? Now they're full of themselves. They think that they're going to crush Israel, and it turned out to be the other way. Sun Tzu says, attack him where he is unprepared. Appear where you are not expected. And then one more. He said, these military devices leading to victory must not be divulged beforehand. You'd be a fool, of course, to let somebody know what your playbook is. If you're, you know, it'd be like if you're playing baseball and you let the other team know what your signals are for, you know, the pitches and steals and that kind of thing. Which leads me to my next example, which is sports. Deception is used in sports all the time, very frequently. I'll just give you some examples. Now, you're going to be really impressed and surprised here that I even know this much about sports, but I do know a thing or two, not very much. So in football, the quarterback will pretend to hand off the ball to another player to take the attention off himself while he passes it to somebody else, right? We've all seen this, right? He gets the ball, and then he passes it off or pretends to pass it off to this guy, and he goes running up through the linebackers, and then the quarterback's running around and throwing it when everybody thinks that the other guy's got the ball. That's deception. Or in baseball, the pitcher will throw a curveball. What is a curveball but deception? Because he's making it look like he's throwing it on the inside of the plate, but where he's actually throwing it at the last second is going to be the outside of the plate. But the batter doesn't know that, right? So it's a deceptive tactic. Or like whenever the pitcher tries to throw somebody out at first, right? He looks towards home plate. He makes it look like he's going to throw, you know, throw a pitch. And all of a sudden at the last minute, without doing a balk, see, I do know a little bit of something. At the last minute, he turns and throws it to first to try to throw the guy out that's leading off. See? And you thought I didn't know anything about sports. That's deception, right? Or in basketball, the player will act as if he's passing the ball only to quickly make some other move and take a shot or pass to somebody else, right? They act like they're throwing it this way, then they go the other way, right? So If you were of such a moral character that you could never deceive somebody, then you shouldn't play sports because you're going to lose, right? Or how about card playing? We've all heard probably the saying, a poker face, right? When you play poker, if you get a good hand, you don't get a big smile on your face, right? And let everybody know you have a good hand, right? When you get a good hand, you look very stoic, right? Or maybe you even look disappointed, where you try to make them think you don't have a good hand. Or if you get a bad hand, and maybe you're going to try to keep betting and betting, and hopefully everybody else will be scared and stop betting, and you can take what's in the pool. I think that's how it works. So you might pretend like, if you have a bad hand, you might pretend like you have a really good hand, right? It's all about deception. And it's perfectly acceptable, assuming that you're not playing for high stakes gambling or something. If you're just playing for fun, then there's nothing wrong with that. Or then how about this one? Playing dumb, right? You ever wonder, like, is it wrong to play dumb? Like maybe you ask a question that you already know the answer to, but you pretend like you don't. Or when somebody tells you something and you already know what they're talking about, but you just pretend like you don't really know what they're talking about and just let them explain it or whatever. Playing dumb, right? Where you're pretending like you don't really know what's going on, but you actually do know what's going on. There is not a thing in the world wrong with that. And I'm going to show you examples of our Lord Jesus Christ did this very thing on numerous occasions. I'm going to give you three of them. Look at Luke chapter 24, 17 through 19. Luke 24, 17 through 19. This is after Jesus was resurrected and he met these men on the road to Emmaus. And it says here in verse 17, "And he said unto them, What manner of communications are these that ye have one to another as ye walk and are sad?" Of course, he knew why they were walking and why they were sad. They were sad because the Messiah had been crucified, right? Of course he knew about it because he was the one that was crucified. But yet he asked this question like he doesn't know. "And one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answering, said unto him, Art thou only a stranger in Jerusalem, and hast not known the things which come to pass there these days?" He's basically pretending to be a stranger in Jerusalem, not letting them know that he knows what's going on. "And he said unto them, What things?" Now this is flat out playing dumb. What things? He clearly knows about the crucifixion of himself. And yet he says, what things? What are you talking about? Pretending like he doesn't know what they're talking about. This is the sinless Son of God. In him is no sin. That means to pretend like you don't know what somebody's talking about is not sinful, because Jesus did it. "And they said unto him, concerning Jesus of Nazareth, which was a prophet mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to be condemned to death and have crucified him." And that's really as far as I need to go there. So yes, he pretended like he didn't know what was going on, but he did. Notice he didn't lie. He just said what things. He didn't tell a lie, but he was acting like he didn't know what they were talking about. Look at John chapter 4. You remember when Jesus met the woman in Samaria, there, whenever he was coming through Samaria, the woman at the well. And he pretends as if he doesn't know her life situation when he did. John chapter 4, verses 16 through 18. "Jesus saith unto her, Go call thy husband and come hither. The woman answered and said, I have no husband. Jesus said unto her, Thou hast well said, I have no husband." See, he knew she didn't have a husband, but yet he said, go call your husband. Right? He pretended like he didn't know, but he did. "For thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband. In that saidst thou truly." So yes, he says, you're telling me the truth. Although she was being a little deceptive herself, wasn't she? Oh, I don't have a husband. I'm just living with a guy, right? She's pretending like she's single, although she's been married five times and now she's living with a guy. And then let me give you one more example. This is whenever Jesus was going to feed the 5,000 in John chapter 6, 5 through 6. So he's got all these people following him. They've been following him for 3 days, and everybody's hungry, and he wants to feed them. And Jesus knows exactly how he's going to feed them because he knows everything, right? But he pretends as if he doesn't, just as a test to see what his disciples will do. John 6 and verse 5, when Jesus then lifted up his eyes and saw a great company come unto him, he saith unto Philip, whence shall we buy bread that these may eat? And this he said to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. But he was pretending as if he didn't have a plan. He didn't know how they were going to feed them. And he's asking Philip. So there's nothing wrong with acting like that, with asking questions when you already know the answer, or acting like you don't know the answer when somebody asks you a question just to get information out of them or something. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, there are times when it's actually the godly thing to do to deceive someone. And I'm going to give you several examples of this. And really, the crucial thing comes down to, more times than not, it's whenever innocent human life is at stake. If there's innocent life at stake, it is permissible to deceive a would-be murderer. As a matter of fact, it's not only permissible, it is necessary. You need to deceive somebody. If somebody is trying to murder an innocent person and you have to lie to save the life of that innocent person, you need to do that. And I will give you several examples in the Bible of people who did just that and were blessed for it, not cursed for it. Now, how can it be that it's ever right to lie and deceive? Because people say, well, wait a minute. I mean, the Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. The Bible tells us, lie not one to another. The Bible's full of condemnation of liars. It says liars will have their part in the lake of fire. So how is it, Pastor, you're telling me it's okay to lie sometime when the Bible says you can't lie? I will explain that. You see, God's law is set up in a hierarchy. And I will prove this. I'm not just going to say it. And when two laws or two principles from Scripture come into conflict, then we must choose the higher law. And I'll give you a couple of examples of this from none other than the life of our Lord Jesus Christ. Look at Matthew chapter 12, verses 1 through 8. Matthew chapter 12, 1 through 8. Now, I am not giving you a license to lie to get yourself out of trouble, to lie to cover up your sin, or any such thing. I am telling you that you can lie to protect innocent human life. That's what I'm telling you. So let's look at it. Matthew 12, 1 through 8. It says, at that time Jesus went on the Sabbath day through the corn, and his disciples were anhungered, and began to pluck the ears of corn and to eat. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto him, behold, thy disciples do that which is not lawful to do upon the Sabbath day. So technically they're breaking the Sabbath. You're not supposed to pick ears of corn on the Sabbath day. Technically they're breaking it. But he said unto them, this is Jesus speaking, have ye not read what David did when he was an hungered, and they that were with him, how he entered into the house of God, and did eat the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, neither for them which were with him, but only for the priests? You see, it was against God's law for anybody but a priest to eat that showbread. And yet David and his men come, and they are hungry. Their lives are in jeopardy here, because they're going to pass out or whatever, right? They're running from Saul, and they don't have enough food to keep them going. And the priest gave David the showbread to eat. Why did he do that? Why did the priest break the law? It's because a higher principle was at stake, right? David's life and his men's lives were at stake, and that priest, therefore, could break the lower law, the law of the showbread, to keep the higher law to preserve human life. This is an example right out of the lips of the Son of God. Or have you not read, verse 5, or have you not read in the law, how that on the Sabbath days the priest in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? Right? On the Sabbath day, the priest still had to work. They still had to do things there in the temple, and yet they were blameless. He'll go on to give another example here in just a second. Verse 5, but I say unto you that in this place is one greater than the temple. But if he had known what this meaneth, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, ye would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. And when he was departed thence, he went into their synagogue, and behold, there was a man which had his hand withered. Did I want to read this far? No, I want to, that would be another example, but we're going to move on from that, and I want to show you another one. I was thinking the next one was in this passage, it's in the next passage. So go ahead and turn with me to John chapter 7. John chapter 7. But in that example, then Jesus stretched forth the man's hand. He healed the man on the Sabbath, once again doing work, and yet showing that it's better to save life than to destroy. So that would trump the Sabbath law. But anyway, look at John chapter 7, 22 through 23. John 7:22 says, Moses therefore gave unto you circumcision, not because it is of Moses, but of the fathers. And ye on the Sabbath day circumcise a man. If a man on the Sabbath day receive circumcision, that the law of Moses should not be broken, are ye angry with me, or at me, because I have made a man every whit whole on the Sabbath day? See, they were upset that Jesus had healed on the Sabbath day, and Jesus says, wait a minute. You guys will circumcise a man on the eighth day. If that eighth day happens to fall on the Sabbath day, you'll circumcise a guy, a baby. Well, circumcision is work, right? It's an operation. So they would do work on the Sabbath day to keep the law of Moses for circumcision. Jesus is showing here there is a hierarchy in laws. It was more important in God's law to circumcise a man on the eighth day than it was to not do that little bit of work on the Sabbath day. So therefore, circumcision law trumps the Sabbath law whenever they come into conflict. And this is the only way it could possibly be, right? It can't be that you can keep both of these laws. You can't do no work and circumcise a man at the same time, right? If you circumcise a man, you're doing work, and if that happens to be on the Sabbath day, you've broke the Sabbath. Except God would not consider it breaking the Sabbath because you are only you're only doing it to keep a higher law, so you're not in violation of God's law and you're not guilty of sin. So this is the principle on which I base this, that it is okay to lie and deceive whenever it comes to saving human life, because saving human life is higher on God's scale than lying and deceiving is. And I'm going to give you several examples of this. So saving innocent life trumps the commandment not to lie. And I'm going to give you several examples that'll make this clear. The first one is the example of Michael, or Michal. I'm not sure how you... I think maybe it's Michal. That sounds less masculine. So we'll call her Michal. Michael kind of sounds a little bit New Agey to me. So Michal, she deceived her own father, Saul. Remember, Michal was David's wife, whom Saul had given her, and it was Saul's daughter. So Saul had David had come into ill repute with Saul. Saul didn't like David because David was better than Saul, and Saul wanted to kill David. Go ahead and turn to 1 Samuel. I don't know if I gave you the verse yet. 1 Samuel 19 and verse 11. So Saul is coming after David to kill him, and Michal does this work of deceit to save her husband's life and to lie to her father. And Michal nor David were ever condemned for this, as I will get into in just a minute. So 1 Samuel 19 and verse 11. Saul also sent messengers unto David's house to watch him and to slay him in the morning. And Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, if thou save not thy life tonight, tomorrow thou shalt be slain. So Michal finds out about this plot to kill David, and she's warning him about it. So Michal lets David down through a window, and then she makes this image and puts it in the bed and makes it look like David is lying in the bed and he's sick. And so that, you know, that Saul's men will think that he's lying there sick and he won't be slain. Let's look at verse 12 and then verses 13 through 16. Verse 12, so Michal let David down through a window, and he went and fled and escaped. Okay, so she's already disobeying the king and her father in this case. But remember, saving life trumps obeying the king or obeying your father even. And then in verses 13 through 16, says that Michael took an image and laid it in the bed and put a pillow of goat's hair for his bolster and covered it with a cloth. And when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, he is sick. See, she's lying. And Saul sent the messengers again to see David, saying, bring him up to me in the bed that I may slay him. And when the messengers were come in, behold, there was an image in the bed with a pillow of goat's hair for his bolster. So she lied. And it sounds like they believed her lie for a while, because it says when Saul sent the messengers again, so the first time he sent them and she says, oh, he's sick, they're like, oh, okay. Well, then they come back a while later and they're like, you know what, I don't care if he's sick, we're going to kill him anyway. And then they go up and they find this goat's hair bolster thing lying underneath the covers. So Michael deceived Saul and lied and used a cunning trick to make him think that David was sick. And then once her deception was found out, then she lied again to cover up her initial deception. Let's look at verse 17. And Saul said unto Michal, why hast thou deceived me so, and sent away mine enemy, that he is escaped? And Michal answered Saul, he said unto me, let me go, why should I kill thee? He didn't say that at all. Michal came up with this deception and let him down through the window. So she lies to cover up her initial lie. Right, that's how lies work, right? You got one lie, you got to use another lie to cover up the first one. And this is what she's doing. Now, in normal circumstances, she'd be in trouble, right? You don't lie, and then you definitely don't lie to cover up a lie. But that's exactly what she's doing. But in this case, God never condemned her nor David for that act. I don't see it in the scripture anyway. I don't see any place where she was ever condemned for this, because she did it to save the life of David. And David was the progenitor of our Lord Jesus Christ. You realize that had Michal not lied and deceived her father and the king, the Messiah would have never been born, because David would have died right there. Think about that. The birth of the Messiah is owing to a deceptive lie. But in this case, that deceptive lie was not sin. It was actually the right thing to do. Then you have the example of Rahab the harlot. This is why I read Joshua chapter 2 this morning. Let's just go ahead and read that again for the sake of anybody maybe hearing this after the fact. Joshua 2 and verses 1 through 7. This is another great example, one of my favorites, of godly deception. Joshua chapter 2, 1 through 7. And Joshua the son of Nun sent out of Shittim two men to spy secretly, saying, go view the land, even Jericho. And they went and came into an harlot's house named Rahab and lodged there. I just can't ever read that passage without thinking about Pastor Mott going to the Philippines and staying in a whorehouse there, not realizing it. But anyway, so he's in good company, I guess. That's what these guys did also. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, there came men in hither tonight of the children of Israel to search out the country. And the king of Jericho sent unto Rahab, saying, bring forth the men that are come to thee, which are entered into thine house, for they be come to search out all the country. And the woman took the two men and hid them, and said thus, there came men unto me, but I wist not whence they were. So she's already lying. She knew from where they were. She knew they were Israelites coming to spy out the land. She was lying. And it came to pass, about the time of shutting of the gate, when it was dark, that the men went out, there's another lie, whither the men went, I wot not, another lie, pursue after them quickly, that's deceit, for ye shall overtake them, there's another one. But she's getting good at this. I mean, she's just rattling off these lies, just one after another. It's like she was a pro. I guess she was a whore, so maybe she was used to lying, I don't know. I guess if you're gonna hide in somebody's house and want them to be a good liar, pick a whorehouse, right? You gotta pick a sinner. They know how to do it the best. But it turns out she was a righteous whore, and she really was, and I'll show that to you. But she had brought them up to the roof of the house and hid them with the stalks of flax which she had laid in order upon the roof, and the men pursued after them the way to Jordan, unto the fords, and as soon as they which pursued after them were gone out, they shut the gate. So yeah, she totally sent those men on a on a hunt that was going to be totally unprofitable because the men were actually up on her roof. She lied, and she was certainly not condemned for that. As a matter of fact, she is listed among the heroes of faith in Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 31. You have to be pretty high up on God's list to make it into Hebrews 11, right? It's not just any Joe Schmo that ends up in Hebrews 11, right? This is the faith chapter. And yet, our sister Rahab made it. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 31. It says, by faith the harlot Rahab perished not with them that believed not when she received the spies with peace. Now, it doesn't tell the whole story there, but we know the whole story. We just read it. Yes, she received them with peace and lied to save their lives, and she is listed as a woman of faith. And as a matter of fact, not only is she said to be a woman of faith, it is said that her actions proved that she was justified in the eyes of God, not condemned in the eyes of God. Look at James 2, verse 25. James 2 and verse 25. This verse has got to just make certain Christians' heads explode. Just got to drive them crazy that a woman like this, who lied and deceived, is said to be justified by her lying and deceiving. It's great. Verse 25, likewise also was not Rahab the harlot justified by works when she had received the messengers and sent them out another way. That work, when she lied and deceived and sent them out the wrong way, that work proved that she was justified in the eyes of God. That was the evidence of her justification. She was a godly, righteous woman. Now, she needed to stop that horror. Pouring around, obviously, and I'm assuming that she did once she came under the roof of the Israelite nation and she came to know the God of Israel. But she was showing that she was a godly woman. Apparently, she knew something about the God of Israel. She had heard about what Israel had done to the other nations, and she wanted to hitch her wagon to the God of Israel. Another example is the Hebrew midwives. We turn back to Exodus chapter 1. The Hebrew midwives were told by the Egyptians, by the king of Egypt, that they were to kill all the Hebrew baby boys because the Israelites were starting to multiply and Pharaoh didn't like that. He didn't want the slaves to be outnumbering the masters. And so he told the midwives that you kill these baby boys. Exodus 1, 15 through 19. And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of the one was Shiphrah, and the name of the other Puah. And he said, when you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, and see them upon the stools. See, Karen and I were just talking about this yesterday. Back in the day, before modern medicine figured out how to screw things up, women knew how to give birth. They were on the stools. They were sitting there, right? And just comes out, right? Gravity takes it out, right? Instead of lying in a bed and trying to push it out, right? Just let the Lord push it out. Let gravity push it out. They knew what they were doing back then. Anyway, when you see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him. But if it be a daughter, then she shall live. Pardon me. How far did I want to read? Lost my place here. Down to verse 19, pardon me. But the midwives feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said unto them, why have you done this thing and have saved the men children alive? And the midwives said unto Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are lively and are delivered ere the midwives come in unto them. That was a flat-out lie. They weren't any more lively than the Egyptians. They were popping them out at the same rate the Egyptians were. Everything was just happening normally. But they made up this story because, well, they had to do something or else they were going to die, right? Pharaoh would kill them if they said, oh, well, we just disobeyed because we didn't want to kill the men children. We saved them all. Off with their heads. So they were lying to save their own lives. And they were lying to save the lives of the baby boys. right? They hadn't been propagandized by Planned Parenthood yet to think that something like that's just fine. So the midwives told this lie to the king of Egypt to deceive him. But guess what God did to the midwives? He didn't condemn them. He didn't say, oh, haven't you read the Ten Commandments yet? Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. He never condemned them for lying to the king. He never condemned them for disobeying the king, right? Even though the Bible says, obey every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, right? It tells us that we're supposed to obey magistrates and so on. And yet they disobeyed the king and they lied and they deceived. And what did God do about it? Well, it says there in verse 20, therefore God dealt with them. I'm sorry. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. So God blessed them. He didn't curse them. That was a righteous, godly lie, because they did it to save life. Now let me give you some other examples of godly deception as well. There was a guy named Jehu, and he was a pretty rough dude, and he deceived these followers of Baal and used subtlety so that he could destroy them. If you look at 2 Kings 10 and verse 19, this is a quite an interesting passage here. 2 Kings 10 and verse 19. Now therefore, let me back up to verse 18. And Jehu gathered all the people together and said unto them, Ahab served Baal a little, but Jehu shall serve him much. Now therefore call unto me all the prophets of Baal, all his servants and all his priests. Let none be wanting, for I have a great sacrifice to do to Baal. Whosoever shall be wanting, he shall not live. But Jehu did it in subtlety, which means he was using deceit and deception, to the intent that he might destroy the worshippers of Baal. He's pretending to be a worshipper of Baal. He says, yeah, Ahab served Baal a little. I'm going to do it a lot. I'm going to be a real hardcore servant of Baal, and I want to have a great big Baal convention. I want all the followers of Baal, everybody, I want you to come here. We're all going to have a big old baleful celebration. That was kind of a play on words there, if you got it. So Jehu accomplished this deception by pretending to be something that he was not, which we just read about there in verse 18, pretending to be a worshiper of Baal. He put on this show to hide his true motives. He says there in verse 20, it says there, and Jehu said, proclaim a solemn assembly for Baal. And they proclaimed it. So he's pretending to be this great big proponent of Baal. Get this big convention going on. And then he slyly makes sure that none of the Lord's people were in the house of Baal. Verse 23. And Jehu went and Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, into the house of Baal and said unto the worshippers of Baal, search and look that there be here with you none of the servants of the Lord, but the worshippers of Baal only. You know, we don't want any of these Christians in here. Get all these worshipers of Jehovah out here. We only want the true believers in Baal. None of these compromisers, none of these guys that, you know, are serving Baal and serving the Lord. We just want just the true worshipers, true believers. This is going to be an exclusive Baal club here. Then when he had them right where he wanted them, he killed them all. Verses 24 through 28. And when they went in to offer sacrifices and burnt offerings, Jehu appointed 80, that's 80, 80 men without, and said, if any of the men whom I have brought into your hands escape, he that letteth him go, his life shall be for the life of him. So you guys, not one of those Baal worshippers better get out of this door without dying. And if one of them gets away, it's going to be your life for his. And it came to pass, as soon as he had made an end of offering the burnt offering, that Jehu said to the guard and to the captains, go in and slay them, let none come forth. And they smote them with the edge of the sword, and the guard and the captains cast them out and went to the city of the house of Baal. And they brought forth the images out of the house of Baal and burned them. And they brake down the image of Baal and break down the house of Baal and made it a draft house until this day. like an outhouse, basically. That's what I'm talking about. Thus Jehu destroyed Baal out of Israel. Talk about a marvelous act of deceit. Get them all together. Make sure you get all the good people out there, you know, the simpletons that happen to be coming to a nice big convention just because they wanted the free food or whatever. Get all the worshipers of God out of here. And then he slays all the worshipers of Baal. That was an act of godly deception. He was executing God's wrath on those people. Then we have the example of Gideon. Gideon was under an oppressive regime of the Philistines. I think it was the Philistines. Turn with me to Judges chapter 6. Judges chapter 6, verses 2 through 6. Midianites, not the Philistines. I knew that didn't sound right. They were under the rule of the Midianites. This happened repeatedly throughout the book of Judges. You'll read where Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he turned them over to some foreign power. A lot of times it was for 20, 30, 40 years, for a long time. And then eventually the people get under that yoke of bondage to where it's so painful they start crying unto the Lord, and the Lord sends them a Savior and delivers them. And Gideon was one of those Saviors. Samson was one of those Saviors. And there were numerous ones. Jephthah, the faithful bastard. I'm not cursing. He actually was a faithful bastard. He was born to a harlot. But anyway, this is what the Lord did. And Gideon was one of these Saviors that he raised up. Well, when they were underneath the thumb of the Midianites, things were bad. They were oppressing them. They were destroying their livelihood. And it was to the point where they basically couldn't feed their families anymore. Verses 2 through 6, Judges 6, 2 through 6. It says, "And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel, and because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them the dens which are in the mountains and caves and strongholds." You remember Hebrews 11? They wandered about in dens and caves of the earth. This is what it was referring to. "And so it was, when Israel had sown, that the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites, and the children of the east, even they came up against them, and they encamped against them, and destroyed the increase of the earth, till thou come unto Gaza, and left no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor ass." So they were destroying their crops, destroying their animals, destroying their livelihood. They basically had nothing to sustain themselves. "For they came up with their cattle and their tents, and they came as grasshoppers for multitude, for both they and their camels were without number, and they entered into the land to destroy it. And Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites. And the children of Israel cried unto the Lord." So they are under such governmental oppression that they can't even provide for themselves. So what do you do in a situation like that? Well, you go to a black market. You sneak around. And you do what you have to, and you hide things from whoever you have to make sure you can provide for yourself. And this is what Gideon did. He deceived the Midianites by threshing wheat by the wine press to hide it from them and provide for his family. Verse 11. "And there came an angel of the Lord and sat under an oak, which was in Ophrah, that pertained unto Joash, the Abiezrite, and his son Gideon threshed wheat by the wine press to hide it from the Midianites." So this is what you call tax evasion, in a sense, right? He was keeping from the Midianites what they were trying to take from him. And in this case, they were trying to take way too much. And he was withholding for himself and his family. Now let's see what the Lord said unto Gideon about this, what the angel of the Lord said. "And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him and said unto him, The Lord is against thee, thou tax protester." Is that what he said? He said, "The Lord is with thee, thou mighty man of valor." The Lord is with thee, hiding it from the government, taking care of yourself. The Lord did not curse him. The Lord blessed him for it. Now, I could liken this to this situation we've just been through with all this forced lockdown and business closures. In fact, I would encourage, and I have actually encouraged business owners to do this, but you know what? Just say no. And if you have to do it secretly, do it secretly. If you're a barber, make your barber shop a speakeasy. Anybody remember the speakeasies? Oh, you can't remember. It was during the Great Depression. I'm just kidding. I didn't think you were that old, but anyway, you know about the speakeasies is the point. So the speakeasies, for those of you who don't know what they were basically like private club bars where you go up to the door, and I don't know if you had a password or something, but they'd open the little thing and you'd say your thing or whatever, and they knew you were one of the ones to let in, and you could go in there and drink. Well, I think these barbershops and places like that ought to just turn them into speakeasies and have closed out there on the sign if you want, but yet tell all your customers, come on in the back door, or come on in, we'll close the blinds, and we're going to cut your hair anyway. Because what right does the government have to put you out of business and starve you and your family to death? They have no right to do that. Then you got a guy named Obadiah, and he did another deceptive act, basically an act of lying, where he hid 100 prophets of the Lord in a cave and fed them to keep them from this wicked queen Jezebel, who was trying to kill them all. 1 Kings 18, verses 3 through 4. Actually, were the speakeasies in the Great Depression? Prohibition was in the early 20s. I don't know when Prohibition was lifted. It was maybe it was during the Depression. I can't remember. But anyway, I have to look that up. 1 Kings 18, 3 through 4. It says, and Ahab called Obadiah, which was the governor of his house. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. For it was so, when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord, that Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water. Now, I'm assuming this was an act of deception and lying. Chances are, right, he would have had to come up with some story or something, right, that he's got these 100 prophets where they can't find him and they're off in a cave somewhere and he's feeding them, and where's he getting all this bread and water from? And I'm sure that there was probably some shenanigans that happened to make sure these guys were cared for and that they weren't found out. He obviously didn't tell Jezebel what he was doing, clearly. And then here's one of my favorite examples. This one, God himself tells Samuel to basically make up a cover story to cover your tracks so that people won't figure out what you're really doing. This one's really neat, I think. 1 Samuel 16 and verse 2. And then I will give you a real-life example of this, too, that I didn't have to do, but I thought about doing anyway. 1 Samuel 16 and verse 2. Austin, don't let me forget. If I forget, tell me. You gotta tell the story about an example of this one. 1 Samuel 16 and verse 2. It says, and Samuel said, how can I go? If Saul hear, he will kill me. And the Lord said, take an heifer with thee, and say, I am come to sacrifice to the Lord. You see, the real reason that Samuel was going there to where Saul was not to make a sacrifice. It was to anoint David king. So the Lord had told him there in verse 1, let's go ahead and read that he was to go anoint David, and Samuel was concerned that Saul would find out and kill him. And the Lord said unto Samuel, how long wilt thou mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill thine horn with oil, and go, I will send thee to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided me a king among his sons. So when you take the horn of oil, it was to anoint David, obviously. He didn't know it was David yet. He was going to go and figure out which of the sons it was. But anyway, Saul was the king. So when Samuel shows up with a horn of oil and saying, hey, I want to go talk to Jesse the Bethlehemite and take a look at his sons, well, obviously Saul's going to know something's going on here. What do you got the oil for? You're going to anoint somebody else king? He's going to kill him, right? So Samuel is rightly concerned about this. And when he says to the Lord, well, how am I going to pull this one off? And then we got verse 2. I'll just read it to you again. And Samuel said, how can I go? If Saul hear, he will kill me. And the Lord said, take an heifer with thee, and say, I'm come to sacrifice to the Lord. That's a cover story. He was not going to sacrifice to the Lord. He was going to anoint a new king of Israel. But he says, take the heifer with you. And then when Saul asks, what are you doing here? He's like, oh, I got this heifer. I'm coming here to make a sacrifice. Technically, that's a lie. But it's not, I guess it's not, I don't know, however you want to call it. technically it's not a lie, and technically it is, right? Because he is actually coming there to make a sacrifice, but that's not really the reason why he was going in the first place, right? The Lord came up with this one. I mean, God sanctioned this. God actually told him to come up with a cover story that was only about half true. This is God, right? Now, I told you I was going to tell you a little story about something that I thought of doing something similar to this. Whenever the lockdown was going on, and we were coming here for church, and I, you know, when it first happened, I didn't know if there were, that the police were going to be stopping people or what. And it was funny, the first Sunday, I passed by like three cops on my way down here, right in the park. I didn't even pull out of the parking lot of the apartment complex, and there's a cop pulling right into the parking lot, and then I passed another one. It was kind of, it was interesting. But anyway, but I had thought to myself that if I get pulled over, I say, oh, I'm going to the gas station to get something to eat. And then, to keep from lying, I would have driven to the gas station and got something to eat, and then I would have gone to church. But so that's exactly what the Lord was telling Samuel to do here. Take a heifer with thee. Actually, when I talked to the Keith at the Law Center, I was talking to him about this very thing, that after I heard about the Clay County order, and I said, I'm going to take a heifer with me. And then I explained the reference. He's like, oh, yeah, good idea. So anyway, then we have David. And in the life of David, we have several examples here of how David lied and deceived to save life, to save his life and to save the men's lives that were with him. David, first of all, had Jonathan lie to Saul about his whereabouts because Saul was trying to kill him. Look at 1 Samuel 20, 5 through 6. 1 Samuel 20, 5 through 6. And David said unto Jonathan, behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with thee or with the king at meat. But let me go, that I may hide myself in the field unto the third day at even. If thy father at all miss me, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me, that he might run to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice, for there for all the family. So he basically comes up with this lie, and that's essentially what Jonathan did in verse 28. It says, and Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. Now, I don't think Saul really believed this because he called him a son of a perverse, rebellious woman. He kind of got angry about that. But the point was, David came up with this lie and Jonathan went along with it. And David was never condemned by God for this deceptive behavior. You know, I don't ever read where David was condemned. I read where David was a man after God's own heart. Now, granted, you got to be careful with that because then you can say God also sanctions adultery and murder and all kinds of stuff, right? So you can't take that man after God's own heart thing too far. But in this case, David was judged for the adultery and murder. David was never judged for this. So I conclude from that that God was perfectly fine with David lying to save his own life. Then David lied to Ahimelech, the priest, when he was running for his life from Saul. 1 Samuel 21, 1 through 2. Then came David to Nob to Ahimelech, the priest, and Ahimelech was afraid at the meeting of David, and said unto him, why art thou alone, and no man with thee? And David said unto Ahimelech, the priest, the king hath commanded me a business, and hath said unto me, let no man know anything of the business whereabout I send thee, and what I have commanded thee, and I have appointed my servants to such and such a place. So he just made that up. The king didn't send him, but he was trying to remain anonymous so Ahimelech didn't know who he was and so on. Maybe he was doing that for Ahimelech's sake as well, because then Ahimelech had plausible deniability where he can say, I didn't know Dave. I mean, David told me he was on some official business. I didn't know he was running from the king. David was never condemned by God for this deceptive behavior either. And then David was afraid of Achish, the king of Gath, and he used deception to make it look like he was a madman so that he would let him go. Verses 13 through 15 of this chapter. David was quite ingenious when it came to running for his life and coming up with all kinds of contrivances to keep himself alive. It says, and he changed his behavior before them and feigned himself mad in their hands. Mad means crazy or insane in those days. And scrabbled on the doors of the gate and let his spittle fall down upon his beard, looking like he's a lunatic. Then said Achish unto his servants, lo, ye see the man is mad. Wherefore have ye brought him to me? Have I need of madmen, and ye have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house? So David escaped there by pretending he was crazy. God never condemned him for it. Then David devised a plan to deceive Absalom in order to get information about his plans in order to defeat him. 2 Samuel 15 and verse 32. See, David had a rough life. Saul tried to kill him and he was on the run from him. Then his own son was trying to kill him, was trying to take the kingdom from him. 2 Samuel 15, 32 through 36. And it came to pass that when David was come to the top of the mount where he worshipped God, behold, Hushai the Archite came to meet him with his coat rent and earth upon his head, unto whom David said, if thou passest on with me, then thou shalt be a burden unto me. But if thou return to the city and say unto Absalom, I will be thy servant, O king, as I have been thy father's servant hitherto, so will I now also be thy servant. Then mayest thou for me defeat the counsel of Ahithophel. So David's basically saying to Hushai, if you stay with me, you're going to be a burden to me, right? I don't need somebody else hanging around here. But if you go to Absalom and you pretend that you're on Absalom's side now, and you call Absalom the king, and you say, I'm your servant, and I'm here to help defeat David, then you'll be helpful to me. Verse 35. And hast thou not there with thee Zadok and Abiathar the priest? Therefore it shall be that what things soever thou shalt hear out of the king's mouth, thou shalt tell it to Zadok and Abiathar the priest. Behold, they have there with them their two sons, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. And by them ye shall send unto me everything that ye can hear. So they would basically go there to be spies and pretend to be on Absalom's side, but all they're doing is collecting information and then passing it on to David. This is espionage, basically. But yet, David was certainly never condemned for it. And then a woman hid these same guys here that were supposed to help him out, Jonathan and Ahimaaz, hid them in a well and lied to Absalom's servant who came looking for them. 2 Samuel 17, 17 through 21. Now Jonathan and Ahimaaz stayed by in Rogo, for they might not be seen to come into the city. And a wench went and told them, and they went and told King David. Nevertheless, a lad saw them and told Absalom. But they went both of them away quickly and came to a man's house in Bahurim, which had a well in his court, whither they went down. And the woman took and spread a covering over the well's mouth and spread ground corn thereon. And the thing was not known. And when Absalom's servants came to the woman, to the house, they said, where is Ahimaaz and Jonathan? And the woman said unto them, they be gone over the brook of water. And when they had sought and could not find them, they returned to Jerusalem. So she hides these guys in a well. She puts a covering over it, puts corn on top of it so they can't tell. And when they come looking for them, she says, well, they went over the brook. She pulled a Rahab, basically, did the exact same thing that Rahab did. And God never condemned her for it. She was never judged for this deceptive behavior. But notice that all of these lies and deceptions were done to preserve life. Every one of them. Right? They weren't just lying to get themselves out of trouble or, you know, to cover up other lies or something like that. Or just to be deceitful, to get some gain from somebody by tricking them. They weren't doing that. They were protecting life. You have another example of deception here. Elisha, he blinded the Syrian army and then he led him to Samaria instead of the city that he told him he would take him to, which is a pretty neat trick. 2 Kings 6 and verse 19. Now Elisha was a good man and he didn't just slay them all when they got there. He was just teaching them a lesson. 2 Kings 6 and verse 9. Second Kings 6:19. And Elisha said unto them, "This is not the way, neither is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom ye seek." But he led them to Samaria. This is after they were blinded. So he says, "Oh, I'll take you where you want to go," and he takes them right into the enemy's land. That's deceptive, but there was nothing wrong with that. And then Jeremiah followed the advice of King Zedekiah and told this made-up story to the princes so that they wouldn't know the truth of what Jeremiah had told the king. Look at Jeremiah 38, 24 through 27. Jeremiah 38, 24 through 27. Then said Zedekiah unto Jeremiah, "Let no man know of these words, and thou shalt not die. But if the princes hear that I have talked with thee, and they come unto thee and say unto thee, declare unto us now what thou hast said unto the king, hide it not from us, and we will not put thee to death, also what the king said unto thee. Then shalt thou say unto them, I presented my supplication before the king, that he would not cause me to return to Jonathan's house to die there." Down to verse 27. Then came all the princes unto Jeremiah and asked him, and he told them according to all these words that the king had commanded. So they left off speaking with him, and the matter was not perceived. So Zedekiah didn't want Jeremiah to tell them what he actually told them. He says, "You tell them something else and save your life." And that's what Jeremiah did. And God blessed Jeremiah's lie, and he saved his life. But just remember, we don't ever want to lie for any other reason besides saving life, or something to that extent which would be a higher law than the lying would be. I'll give you another example, and then I want to give you one last thing of a verse that people use or could use to justify deceiving people, which should not be used to justify people, to deceive people. But let's look first of all at Paul. One more example here of godly deception. He deceived the authorities who were trying to kill him by being let down over a wall in a basket. Look at Acts chapter 9, 23 through 25. I've given you a lot of examples because I know that these are hard things to hear, and there's going to be people that will hear this topic and automatically dismiss it. But if you're going to dismiss it, you've got to dismiss about a dozen examples in Scripture of it as well. Acts chapter 9, 23 through 25. And after that many days were fulfilled, the Jews took counsel to kill him, that is to kill Paul. But their laying a weight was known of Saul, and they watched the gates day and night to kill him. Then the disciples took him by night and led him down by the wall in a basket. So from another passage that we'll read here in 2 Corinthians 11, we're going to see that it wasn't just the Jews that were trying to kill him. It was actually the governor of the city was in on this too. It was the government that was trying to kill him as well. The Jews, I'm sure, probably stirred up the government officials and tried to get them to kill Paul. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul tells this story, briefly recounts this story, in verses 32 and 33. He says, "In Damascus, the governor under Aretas, the king, kept the city of the Damascenes with a garrison, desirous to apprehend me. and through a window in a basket, I was let down by the wall and escaped his hands. So here he was running from the government, disobeying the orders of the governor, because it was to save his life. So we can do that under those circumstances. Paul was never condemned by God for deceiving the authorities to escape their persecution. You see, there's a time to flee, and there's a time to fight. Jesus fled several times, right? They tried to take him, and he went through their hands. He disappeared on a couple of different occasions. There's nothing wrong with fleeing when the time is right. Now, I do want to go over this one last verse here, which I'm going to have a few verses to support this, but this one last verse where you might think that Paul is telling us that he deceived people, but this is actually not the case when we look at the context. 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 16. Paul says, "But be it so, I did not burden you. Nevertheless, being crafty, I caught you with guile." Now, it sounds like Paul was using guile to trick them and to catch them. And honestly, and I hate to even admit this, but there was a time in my life, probably not all that long ago, which I never really looked at the context of this, never paid real close attention to it. I just knew that verse was there, and I would jokingly say, "Oh, you know, being crafty, I caught you with guile," or something like I thought that Paul was saying that he used trickery to somehow, you know, trick them into believing the gospel or something like that. And that's kind of, you know, where I would say, you know, where you might not want to tell somebody everything you know and just tell them a little bit until they learn a little bit and then tell them more as they're able to hear it kind of thing. Whereas you're kind of catching them with guile, right? You're not telling them, "Hey, we don't celebrate Christmas first thing," right? You wait a while and you tell them that, you know, it's not, we're not hiding things from people, but we're giving it to them as they can take it, right? Nothing wrong with that, but that is not what Paul's talking about here. That has nothing whatsoever to do with what Paul is talking about here, and that's what I want to show you here. So somebody might conclude here, well, it's okay to be crafty and catch somebody with guile because that's what Paul said he did. But if we look closer, it's going to reveal here that Paul is not admitting to them that he used craftiness and guile to deceive them. And you say, well, how can you say that? Because he says, "Being crafty, I caught you with guile." And Pastor, you're saying he was not crafty and didn't catch them with guile. Who am I going to believe? You or Paul? Because Paul says he was and you say he wasn't. I'll make my case here. The context of the passage is that Paul was not taking financial support of them, of the Corinthian church, which he was entitled to, like he did from the other churches. So let's just read the context. Remember the old saying, text out of context is pretext. So 2 Corinthians 12, 13 through 15. "For what is it wherein ye were inferior to other churches, except it be that I myself was not burdensome to you? Forgive me this wrong." He wasn't burdensome to them in taking financial support from them. And he's actually asking forgiveness because he did this with good motives. He wanted to preach the gospel to them freely, and he didn't want them to think that he was in it for the money or something. So he didn't take any financial support from them, but he did from other churches. And then he realized after the fact, you know what, actually that was wrong. I shouldn't have done that. I was, you know, whether he was depriving them of a blessing or what the reasoning for that was, but he came to the realization that that wasn't a good idea in this case. Verse 14, "Behold, the third time I'm ready to come to you, and I will not be burdensome to you, for I seek not yours, but you, for the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children." Even at this point, he's still not going to do it. This is an immature church. They've got all kinds of problems. He had rebuked them once already, and they had done the right thing, but now he's afraid, as he goes on to say in the rest of the chapter, that when he comes, he's going to find all kinds of problems, and he just doesn't want to add that to the mix. He wants to take care of them, get their problems straightened out, and then they can start supporting the ministry. But he just wanted to leave off on that for the time being. He says, "For the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children. And I will very gladly spend and be spent for you, though the more abundantly I love you, the less I be loved." That's sometimes how it happens. You know, like whenever you chasten your children, and you are doing it because you love them, right? "He that spareth his rod hateth his son." And yet the children don't perceive that abundant love as such, do they? They think, oh, you hate me, you're mean to me, why are you spanking me? But Paul, he did love them, and that's why he rebuked them. And then he goes on to give verse 16. But be it so, I did not burden you. Nevertheless, being crafty, I caught you with guile. So he said, I didn't burden you, but I caught you with guile and I was crafty. Now, I will get into what that means here in just a second. First of all, let me establish for you that Paul did not use guile or craftiness in his ministry. I'm going to give you several verses here. 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 3. 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 3. I want to show you a whole bunch of verses which Paul says emphatically that he did not use craftiness and guile in his ministry. 1 Thessalonians 2, 3, verse 3 and 2, verse, chapter 2, verses 3 and 5. There we go. He says, for our exhortation was not of deceit, nor of uncleanness, nor in guile. See, now here in one place he says, we did not use deceit and guile. But in 2 Corinthians, he's saying, I caught you with guile. So we're gonna see the reconciliation of this here in a minute. Verse 5. For neither at any time used we flattering words, as ye know, nor a cloak of covetousness. God is witness. So he wasn't one to use flattering terms and trying to trick people, pulling the wool over their eyes. Look at 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 2. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 2. He says, but have renounced the hidden things of dishonesty, not walking in craftiness, nor handling the word of God deceitfully, but by manifestation of the truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. This is how Paul used to act. He used to use deceit. He used to use craftiness, but he says, we have renounced that. No more deceit, no more craftiness. But yet he said in 2 Corinthians 12, after he wrote this passage in chapter 4, he said that being crafty, we caught you with guile, or I caught you with guile. But yet here he says, I've renounced that. I don't use craftiness. I don't use deceitfulness. Now, why is he saying he doesn't use it in one chapter, and then he says he did use it, and he is using it in another chapter? Look at chapter 7 and verse 2. I love this kind of thing. I love to get you all confused. And you're like, wait a minute, which is it? Did he do it or did he not do it? And it's kind of fun. Verse 2. Then we'll bring it all together and it'll be clear as crystal, hopefully. 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 2. Receive us. We have wronged no man. We have corrupted no man. We have defrauded no man. He says, we've defrauded nobody, but yet, being crafty, I caught you with guile. Which is it? Romans 13 and verse 13. Romans 13 and verse 13. He said, let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting. I think some people around here need to hear this verse. It's people in these cities. Not in rioting or drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying, but walking honestly. Paul is telling the saints to walk honestly, but yet he's saying that he himself uses craftiness and guile. Which is it? And then Hebrews 13 and verse 18. Hebrews 13 and verse 18. Pray for us, for we trust we have a good conscience in all things, willing to live honestly. So there, he said it seven ways from Sunday. We live honestly, we've renounced deceitfulness and craftiness. I haven't used guile, right? He has denounced this and renounced it. Now here's the answer, part of it. Paul often anticipated his enemies' objections and answered them preemptively. Let me show you an example of this, a couple of them. Romans chapter 3 and verse 5. Romans chapter 3 and verse 5. I'll just give you a little hint here. What Paul is saying when he says, with craftiness I caught you with guile, he is telling them what his enemies are saying of him. He is telling them what he is accused of that he has done, but he has not done it. So I'm building up to that. So Paul often anticipates his enemy's objections, gives the objection, and then answers it. This is exactly what he's doing in 2 Corinthians 12, but let me give you these examples first. Romans 3, 5 through 8. He says, if our unrighteousness commend the righteousness of God, what shall we say then? Is God unrighteous who taketh vengeance? I speak as a man. See, he's anticipating his argument. Well, is God unrighteous then for taking vengeance, right? I mean, after all, if our sin's going to make him his justice prevail anyway, then is he unrighteous for taking vengeance? God forbid, he says. And then in verse 8, he said, and not rather as we be slanderously reported, and as some affirm that we say, let us do evil that good may come, whose damnation is just. Right? Some people were saying, let us do evil that good may come. They were saying that Paul was saying that. They were saying that Paul was teaching salvation by grace, which means that you can just do evil and good's going to come of it, because God is going to continue to cover up that sin. The more you sin, the more he's going to cover it up. And Paul says, their damnation is just, people that say that. Paul never said, let us do evil that good may come. That's what other people said that he said. Look at Romans 6 and verse 1. What shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? You see, he's predicting the argument, the counter-argument that's going to be brought up. When Paul says that where sin did abound, grace did much more abound, and he says then, okay, so should we continue in sin that grace may abound? Right? He's anticipating their objection and bringing it up and answering it. Romans 9 and verse 14. He did this a lot. Romans 9, 14 and 19. What shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? God forbid. Right? He teaches the doctrine of election, and he knows the first objection is going to be, that means God's not fair. Right? God's not righteous. How could he love one and hate the other? And by the way, let me correct what I said last week. He hated Esau, not Jacob. Last week I said he hated Jacob. Okay? I have since learned that it was actually Esau, and I repent of my error. But what shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? So he predicts the argument and then says, God forbid, and then he gives the reason for it in the next couple of verses. And then verse 19. Thou wilt say then unto me, why doth he yet find fault? For who hath resisted his will? Well, if God has mercy on whom he will, then why would he find fault on me? I mean, if after all, if he just arbitrarily chooses one and not the other one, then why would he be mad at me if I have no choice? Because I'm just a sinner. I was born that way. So he puts down the objection and answers it. Romans 11 and verse 19. Thou wilt say then, the branches were broken off, that I might be grafted in. See, he anticipates the objection again. Oh, well, I guess that means that us Gentiles are pretty special because God broke off those Jews and brought us in. Said, yeah, well, you better not be high-minded but fear, because he could break you off too. See, but he's anticipating the objection and answering it. It appears to me that he's doing the exact same thing in 2 Corinthians 12. In verse 16. So let's go ahead and read that verse again. Being mindful of the context. So the context was that he did not take financial support from them. He was not burdensome unto them. And then he says there in verse 16, but be it so, I did not burden you. Nevertheless, being crafty, I caught you with guile. I didn't burden you, but I was crafty and caught you with guile. I used sleight of hand. I tricked you and somehow and ended up getting the money out of you anyway, but I didn't outrightly ask for it. I wasn't burdensome to you, but I got it another way. Now, why I say this is when we go on to read the next verse here. You see, he was speaking as one of his enemies would speak and suggesting that though he did not take money from the Corinthian church directly, he did so craftily with guile by getting it indirectly through others. He then goes on to refute this claim by showing that he did not make a gain of them by any of the men that he sent to them. Let's read verses 17 through 19. This is why I say that he is giving the objection that they're probably thinking in their own heads. Oh yeah, you didn't take money from us, but you tried to send somebody else to get money from us indirectly. So he's coming, he's giving that objection, and then he's going to show why that's not true. Verses 17 through 19. Did I make a gain of you by any of them whom I sent unto you? I desired Titus, and with him sent a brother. Did Titus make a gain of you? Walked we not in the same spirit? Walked we not in the same steps? Did Titus get any money from you? Did I send Titus here, and he got money, he took up a collection from you that he somehow secretly gave to me? Titus didn't take any money from you. I sent other people to you. Did they take any money from you? No. Nobody took any money from you. How is it that I have caught you with guile and craftiness then? You see, Paul was very careful to have other men go with him for accountability's sake. When he took up an offering from the Corinthian church to the church in Judea, which was in need, he made sure and had other men go with him so that there was no question as to whether he was being honest with that money. Look at 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 3. It appears that Paul, he was wise, and he recognized that it would be pretty easy for somebody to accuse him of getting money out of them, overtly or covertly, either one. And so whenever they took up this collection for the poor saints in Jerusalem, he was very careful to have other people go with him because he didn't want anybody to be able to say, you have used craftiness and caught us with guile. You took up this collection for the poor saints in Judea, but then whenever you got down to the poor saints in Judea, only half of it ended up going to them, and the other half ended up in your pocket, Paul. So Paul was very careful to take other people with him so that there was complete accountability. 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 3. And when I come, whomsoever, so he's instructed them to lay by themselves the first day of every week, so that they'll have to give to this need in Judea. And when I come, whomsoever ye shall approve by your letters, them will I send to bring your liberality unto Jerusalem. So whoever they said, whoever they approved, he was going to send them to take that money to Jerusalem. Look at 2 Corinthians 8, verses 18 through 21. 2 Corinthians 8, 18 through 21. It says, and we have sent with him the brother whose praise is in the gospel throughout all the churches, and not that only, but who was also chosen of the churches to travel with us with this grace. The grace he's referring to is this charitable giving to the church in Judea. And they were the ones that chose him. That's the verse we just read there in 1 Corinthians. Which is administered by us for the glory of the same Lord and the declaration of your ready mind, avoiding this, that no man should blame us in this abundance, which is administered by us, providing for honest things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. So he had a brother that they chose to go along with him when he took this money to Judea, so that that brother could affirm, yep, there was 100 pieces of silver in there when we left Corinth, and there was 100 pieces of silver delivered to the Judean church. And nobody could accuse Paul of any type of deceit or craftiness or guile. So Paul did not use deceit and guile to trick the Corinthians out of their money, obviously. So that is my explanation there of that verse. And that seems to me make the most sense to me to make sense of it. Otherwise, he says a half a dozen places that I don't use craftiness, guile, and deceitfulness, and I'm perfectly honest. And he went to great pains to make sure that they knew that in whenever he took the money to Judea. He's certainly not telling them now that, yeah, I didn't burn you, but I craftily, with guile, got it another way. That's not what he's saying. He was perceiving their argument ahead of time and answering it. So 2 Corinthians 12:16 should never be used to justify ungodly deception to get what we want. Now, the deception series is finally over, and I'm going to give you just a brief review of what we covered so far. Very brief. So we started out warning to not be deceived, and we showed all the verses in the Bible that give us all those warnings about be not deceived. We looked at the nature of deception, how it's done. We looked at the victims of deception, so we saw who the types of people are that are most likely to be deceived, so we can avoid being them. We looked at the characteristics of deceivers so we can more easily identify them. We looked at Satan, the great deceiver, spent a couple of Sundays looking at Satan and looked at how he deceived Eve in the Garden of Eden. We looked at false prophets and false preachers. We looked at examples of deceivers, Jacob and Laban. Linda heard the Jacob one out there for the Bible study. That was part of this bigger study. We looked at the methods of deception and spent several weeks looking at the various methods that people use to deceive. Then we looked at the motivations for deception, why deceivers deceive. We spent a couple of Sundays looking at self-deception, why and how we deceive ourselves. And then we spent a couple of Sundays looking at how to resist deception. And now we've summed it up with godly deception and showing that there are times, mainly whenever human innocent life is at stake, that we can deceive and lie in order to save life. So I hope that this was a profitable study for you anyway, and next week we will move on to the proverbial bigger and better things, whatever that might be.